Certainly very nice here and very snowy. Yeah, so indeed, so the title of my talk is Geometric Phases in String Theory. And by that, I mean mostly Berry-type phases, so geometric in the sense of quantum mechanics. So that's everything that I'm talking about today is work that I've been doing with David Tong and Chris Petter, who are also both in Cambridge. And so there are two papers that we put out. The first one, really, I'm not going to have very much time to talk about today. I'm going to give you a brief fact sheet about what we did there. I am going to talk mostly in detail about this. And in the end, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some work that's in progress. So all of this kind of falls into this project that we're undertaking with the goal to compute these non-abelian type Berry phases in strongly interacting quantum mechanical systems, and to do so by using insights from string theory. Perhaps in the future, so if this you know, becomes a viable technique, which I hope I can actually convince you that in the context of D-brain systems it is, then we would like to use it to actually calculate these Berry phases in strongly interacting systems where they are of interest to other people, such as in, say, condensed matter theory, or in topological quantum computation, where these non-abelian braiding statistics are used to encode information. OK. So the content of my talk, I'm going to have a pretty detailed review of the geometric phase. And I apologize to everybody who knows this in detail. I think it's very good to sort of establish the language. But then also, I'm going to use this to go to the non-abelian geometric phase. So this is something which perhaps is less familiar. So the first item here, this geometric phase, was introduced by Michael Berry. He's also called the Berry phase. And this extension was done by Wilczek and Z. And it's probably more properly called the non-abelian geometric holonomy. Then I'm going to talk about geometric phases in 2,2 supersymmetric systems very briefly, which is essentially the first paper that I flashed there. And the second paper is on 4,4 supersymmetric systems. And the Berry phases will turn out to be related to these nice geometric objects called the Yang monopole. And it applies to the 0-4 system in string theory. I'm then going to give you an overview of how this supersymmetry theme fits into the picture of Berry phases that I'm developing here. And I'm going to use it to give you an outlook on what happens if you go to the 8,8 model, so 16 supercharges. I should say that in quantum mechanics, really, this means having 4 real supercharges, this means having 8 real supercharges, and this means having the maximum amount of 16 real supercharges. Then I'm going to conclude. Please, of course, always interrupt if there are some things that are unclear. Right, so here is how I'm thinking about the Berry phase. Or at least, well, I pinched the slide from David Tong, so we should acknowledge him. So what do you do with the Berry phase? So you have some quantum mechanical system as represented by a Hamiltonian. So this could be some experimental setup, some actual experiment that you're performing. And this experiment depends on a set of parameters. So this you can think of as being some applied field or a temperature or whatever, but it is up to the experimenter to change these parameters, and if you want, even in a time-dependent fashion. So I can adjust these styles that I'm representing here, and it will then, through the parametric dependence and the Hamiltonian, drive the system through some kind of evolution as I change them. Another question is, what is this evolution? Okay, so in quantum mechanics, the question that you will ask is, well, you set up the system in some particular energy eigenstate at some time, and then you drive the system that has been set up in this eigenstate through the parameter change by dialing you know, whatever you want, coming back to where you started. Right? So you make some change, you come back exactly to the parameter values that you started off, and then you ask, has the state actually changed? Okay. So now there are two remarks there, or perhaps a few more. But importantly, of course, this thing is physical, right? Everybody always thinks in quantum mechanics, phases don't matter. But because you could think of setting up two eigenstates, you drive the one through this evolution, the other one you just, you know, prepared to propagate in just its eigenstate. If you let them interfere, you're actually talking about a phase difference here with this Berry phase. So it is something that's physical. Now, in order to really make progress there, I have to make this assumption of slow parameter change. So slow parameter change in the sense of the adiabatic theorem, which means that if you have some sort of gapped system, so your eigenstate has a gap in energy to the other states, then if you drive the system through these parameter changes very slowly, then it will instantaneously always cling to the eigenstate that you prepared it in. So this eigenstate, of course, now also is a function of the parameters. In other words, what the quantum evolution does, it gives you a law of parallel transport of a quantum state on the space of parameters. And that's essentially what we're looking at with this Berry phase. Right, so that depends on the system. That's a good question, and it depends on how big the gap is and so on. So essentially what you want to do is you want to suppress transitions between states. So you have to look at, you know, the details of the system to answer that question. Right, so so let me go over what's perhaps the canonical example of a Berry phase. So this is a spin 1/2 particle in an external magnetic field, so B. Here is a 3-vector of magnetic fields, and sigma are just the Pauli matrices. What this cartoon picture is supposed to indicate to you is that if you take a more complicated system, but it is a two-state system, then at the point of level crossing, so these two levels can cross at some point, at this point of level crossing, the behavior of any system is, so close to this point, is linear in these applied parameters. So this is quite a general sort of phenomenon that I'm talking to, that I'm telling you now, provided that you're close to a point of level crossing, even in a complicated system. Now, I'm now slowly changing the magnetic field. So I'm going through some path in the space of magnetic fields, and I'm going to do it in a slow enough way for the adiabatic theorem to apply. And as I told you then, I'm getting a law of parallel transport for, say, the spin-up state that I choose at the beginning. And now let's actually work out what this law of parallel transport is. So here is a very simple exercise. It's just a two-state system, so there are these two eigenstates, call them B plus minus, which have energy plus B and energy minus B, respectively. And I pick the ground state as being the spin-up state, and I sort of instantaneously normalize it to zero energy. So this is what this thing is doing, right? So B is now, because B changes, right? So this eigenvalue also changes as a function of P. Now, at every point, I can just choose to take away this length of the vector B, which just means that at every point, I have zero energy, even for this kind of Hamiltonian. And why that's useful, we'll see in a second. So what happens if B is varied? Well, this is the picture. So I have here again R3, which is precisely the space of parameters of magnetic fields, and I'm indicating that the path I'm taking as this closed curve. At every point, now I still have this phase ambiguity of the wave function, which is indicated by theta, which is is acted on by U1. And so if you just plug in to the Schrödinger equation and you try to see what's the solution as you invoke the adiabatic theorem, this is the answer. So B plus at some time t in terms of B plus at the initial time, say here. So this has two contributions. This has this contribution here, which is just the integral over the instantaneous energy. And this is referred to as the dynamical phase. That's kind of what you would have guessed as a zeroth order guess, what is the overall solution. But Berry actually showed that there is this second term here, which is the line integral of this connection A that I'm writing on here. So what is this connection? Well, I take the state as a function of time, and I take the derivative, the exterior derivative. So that's the exterior derivative on this R3 here, right? So that's d by dbi, if you wish. And then I'm taking the overlap with itself. And this I is just here to make sure that it's a Hermitian connection. So now this is a U1 connection. And the gauge freedom is essentially reflected by the initial choice of phase that I can make here. So there's some choice that I can make. And that's precisely, if you plug that in here, you can see that it acts like a gauge transformation on this A. Okay, so what I haven't told you now is, what is this A for our spin 1/2 system? So for each quantum system, there will now be some kind of gauge connection. It's not a dynamical gauge connection in any sense of the word. It's basically a fixed object, like some, you know, line bundle in this case, that is given by the dynamics and the parameters of the system. So what is it for our spin 1/2 system? Well, you just do this, so you normalize the ground state, which is accordingly. This is always very important in these computations, and if you forget it, you don't get the right answer. And the Berry connection then is simply the Dirac monopole. So I'm not showing you the details of the computation, but you can convince yourself that if you just do this, you get precisely the local, in some patch, you get the expression for the vector potential of the Dirac monopole. And then the geometric phase literally means that. It just modulates the wave function by a phase as you go around this curve. So, okay, so here are a couple of remarks. One is, this is very confusing, because now I have two magnetic fields floating around. So perhaps, is there some, yeah, there is some shock. So I should tell you that now there is this dB plus of t, which is just d by dBi of b plus of t. Okay, so this is the derivative on the space of fields. So what I have now is I have a Dirac monopole connection, which is a magnetic field on the space of magnetic fields. Okay, so I have spontaneously created a magnetic field on the space of parameters, which is just the space of magnetic fields here. And the Berry phase is simply the flux of this spontaneously created magnetic field through the loop I'm tracing out in parameter space. Right, so there was this loop. We can go back to that. This is a loop on the space of magnetic fields, and there is some flux, which is sourced by the center here of, you know, this Dirac monopole. And the flux through this loop is precisely the modulation of the wave function after a quantum evolution. Now, this Berry connection has two types of singularities. It has a singularity at the center, which is physical. This singularity at the center actually reflects the fact that at the center, so at the point B is equal to zero, zero applied field, means that the states become degenerate. And if I have, you know, these two states becoming degenerate, then the assumption of the adiabatic theorem must break down, because there is no gap anymore. And in some sense, that's all there is in terms of the physics. So the physics of this level crossing via this kind of holonomy that you pick up precisely gives you the quantum evolution even away from the origin. There is also this Dirac-like singularity that you always have in a local expression for a monopole like this. And this is just a gauge artifact. And as I told you, there was a gauge choice in defining the initial state. And I can choose the Dirac spring to be wherever I want by choosing the initial state differently. OK, so any questions to this sort of familiar topic? OK, so then I'll move on to the non-abelian Berry phase, which is perhaps less familiar. So what I've been assuming all this time is that apart from this singular point of level crossing, the state that we've been following was unique. There was no other state at the same energy. Well, now if I actually relax this condition and replace it by, say, a stronger assumption that there is always more than one state which is degenerate in energy. So this is stronger because that's a very non-generic state of affairs. It means that there has to be some kind of symmetry that ensures that that is the case.
The parameters slowly go in the derivation of the Berry phase?
Yes. So what you need to do in order to establish that this solves the Schrödinger equation, so you plug it into the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and you find that there are states which basically are transitions between b minus of t and b plus of t, right? And in order for this to be an exact solution, you have to set all of these matrix elements to zero. Okay? Okay, so now the same is true here now, but now you have energy eigenspaces that are more than one dimensional. So now I have an instantaneous basis. So there is now some n-fold degenerate state, so little n-fold degenerate. And this thing has a natural UN action on it, which just means that I can choose any complex linear combination of these degenerate states instantaneously. Now, then it's very natural to form this object, which is a little n by little n matrix. So I take the bth eigenstate at time t, take the exterior derivative on the space of parameters, and I take the overlap with the eighth eigenstate. So now there are two generalizations that I'm putting in here. I'm also allowing the parameter space to be capital N dimensional. So let me explain again here. So now this A has two indices, two types of indices, as a gauge field does. So it has this mu index, which goes from 1 to capital N, the number of parameters. This was 3 for the magnetic field because it was a vector in free space. And A and B go from 1 to little n, which is the number of degenerate states. Okay, and so it's a n by n, it's a UN gauge connection. So well, how do you see that it's a UN gauge connection? Well, one of the things you can do is, for instance, you can look at, suppose I chose some linear combination omega AB of the states B at T, and I formed the same connection. But what happens is that as the exterior derivative acts on this matrix omega, it creates this inhomogeneous term of the UN gauge transformation, and the other one, well, it's just what it is. Okay, so then at the end of the evolution, you can show that the solution of the Schrödinger equation now is the path-ordered exponential, so to speak, the Wilson loop of this induced non-abelian gauge connection.
I don't think so. So relativistic probably means that the adiabatic theorem breaks down. So I'm not aware of any, but it's not, I'm not, I wouldn't exclude it completely, but I'm not aware of any of it.
Sorry, and I think you said this already, but just a second. So there's a singularity at the origin because the states all become degenerate.
That's correct.
And then the connection has a line of singularity along some direct monopole.
Well, that was the case with the Dirac monopole. So this is, of course, now you have to have here. You have to have a quantum system such as one I will present in a bit, where you actually have this degeneracy as you change these parameters, with the exception of the origin. And then you might not get the Dirac monopole. You might get a completely different object. It turns out that object that we will get also has these Dirac type string singularities. But I'm not sure that that's a completely generic feature.
I mean, again, to get anything interesting from this, I just expect that. Don't really want the thing to be defined on our end, but you want it to be defined on something that's not simply connected. You're going to want to cut out a piece of the line.
Right. Okay, so this is your point about the singularity of the origin. But this
well,
is.
No, no, not the origin. I mean, you need a line. Mm-hmm. If you just remove the origin, it's still simply connected. You need more.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, so this is all I had in the way of review. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to demonstrate to you that supersymmetry and Berry phases, in particular non-abelian Berry phases, are quite natural, because supersymmetry can help us to, you know, have a mechanism by which the degeneracy of states is guaranteed under variations of a parameter. I'm going to show you two very different examples of supersymmetric systems and non-abelian Berry phases. And as I said, unfortunately, I really only have time to talk about 4.4 in detail. But the interesting thing in comparison to 2.2 is that there are very different mechanisms to ensure this degeneracy over the range of parameters. And for the 4.4 case, I'm going to give you a new interpretation of the Berry phase in terms of the precession of Dbrings. Okay, so here is the little fact sheet on what we did for the 2.2 geometric phase. So take supersymmetric quantum mechanics with 4 supercharges. This is, of course, precisely the same content as n equals 1 in 4 dimensions. So you can use that language to describe your multiplets. And then what you do is essentially you play around with the various multiplets and theories that you can write down, and you try to identify parameters that you might interestingly change to generate some geometric phases. So first of all, take a free Carré multiplet and give it some mass. So the way that you can give it some mass, there's, you know, there's a sort of a sleight of hand. You can gauge some flavor symmetry.
And this gauging of the flavor symmetry really gives you three mask parameters. You can also think of just coupling it to a background linear multiplier and then setting the gauge coupling to infinity, so you couple the dynamics of this background multiplier. But at any rate, there are three masses, and these three masses play a role that is precisely analogous to the magnetic field. So now I have, say, a vector of masses, and that couples precisely in the same way as the spin 1/2 particle. And so not surprisingly, you get this direct monopole-type phases under variation of these masses. Now, what you can do, though, now that you have supersymmetry, is you can actually explicitly do more complicated examples. So you write down interacting theories with certain potentials, and you find that here now the phase of this this very phase is actually protected by supersymmetric non-normalization theorems, so that even far away from these level crossing points, you still have the direct monopole. Okay, so this is, in some sense, an abelian very phase, and so not really the main interest of what we're doing. So what you can do to get a non-abelian very phase, which is quite exciting, you can, okay, so you play with your parameters, and you play with them in such a way that you construct the CP1 sigma model with a potential. And it is a potential that has two minima. So now I have precisely the situation where I have two degenerate states. These are ground states of the system. And the non-trivial fact that supersymmetry gives us is that under infinitesimal deformations of the system, these multiple vacua are protected by the Witten index. So you're not just going to lose them if you're making small deformations in the parameters of the system. And you can show that there is a non-abelian holonomy which interpolates between the two vacua. So let me briefly sketch to you also what I mean by this. So you have these two vacua, and in each of them, approximately, the phase, so if you just look at them isolated, and you notice that they don't really feel the curvature of the target space, you have a direct monopole connection. Okay, so I can form this type of matrix. So I have two vacua, one I call 1 and the other one I call 2. And then I can write a connection like this. And now the question is, what happens to these off-diagonal terms here? So let me just tell you. So this is like 1, d1, and this is like 2, d2. And then I have these terms here, 1, d2. And 2d1. And you just calculate what these things are, these matrix elements. It turns out that the variation of this state 2, the overlap with state 1, happens to be a 2 Fermi correlation function. And this 2 Fermi correlation function receives an instanton contribution. So the first correction away from 0 is a 1 instanton contribution. And this contribution we calculated. And what it gives you is it gives you an overall connection omega, which is now, a priori U2 value. And it turns out that you can actually compute it, and it is of the top Polyakov type form. So what you've done now is you've constructed a non-abelian type Berry phase out of stringing together these two direct monopoles, and you have two vacua, and you interpolate between the two by using DPS instantons. So this is the first way in which we're establishing that supersymmetry establishes a non-abelian geometric phase, which are usually quite hard to come by. Okay, so this is the fact sheet on 2.2.
What is the coupling constant?
Yeah, so it's so you have this phi Leopoldis parameter, which gives you the radius of the target space CP1 r, and so it's like 1 over m times r. Where m is the length of the mass. So you still have a mass of the prior multiples. Okay, so this is the dimensionless coupling here. Good point.
So I didn't quite follow all that, but you had a Swift-Polyakov monopole.
Yeah.
Can I not choose a gauge where basically it's not a non-abelian theory anymore, where basically the field is all basically just a U1 field?
So that's actually, so we use that fact to compute what this correction is. So you mean you align it, say, along the three direction color space. Yeah, so this is like a singular gauge term. Okay. So yeah, but that's generally true, I think, about these type of connections.
So what am I, but the point is, I'm, well, okay, the question is that I'm putting it there, sort of I'm turning everything back into a U1 H field. So what am I getting that's really new in this non-abelian setup?
Well, no, but sorry, but this I think your question would apply to the Polyakov monopole in general. So you don't really doubt that that's a non-abelian object. It just happens to be a singular gauge in which you can align it along the three directions.
Global.
Yeah, so it's I think it's a statement that the top Polyakov monopole looks the same as the Dirac monopole in the far jump away from it, and then you in the singular gauge. Right?
Okay,
so any other questions? Right, so if you turn to a system with eight supercharges, you can also construct a non-abelian holonomy, but in a completely different way. And so that's what I'm going to tell you about now. So the fact that we have two states, so the generate pairs again, here is not a consequence of having vacua that are protected by the Witten index,
but rather because the pairs of this system are forced to come in degenerate pairs because of what's called Kramers degeneracy. So this is something which goes back to the early days of quantum mechanics. And essentially, if you have time reversal invariant systems, so you have this time reversal invariance operator, you can use it to map an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian to the time reversed eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And this time reversed eigenstate of the Hamiltonian will, of course, be degenerate in energy. And now what you need to show is you need to impose some extra conditions which allow you to show that this time-reversed eigenstate is actually different from the one that you started with. And if all these conditions are, if all these conditions hold, then you always are guaranteed to have at least two states of the same energy, okay? Or two exactly related by this time-reversal operator.
But I mean, I'm looking at the eigenstates, right? So these are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So these are the eigenstates at some time t. Okay, and so
I have this time reversal invariant. So at every time t, they're guaranteed to be twofold degenerate. And then the state actually, I mean, so these two states will change as you change the time. But I'm talking about, you know, instantaneous eigenstates. So, and the nice thing about this kind of system is that you can write down, of course, a Lagrangian which describes precisely this de zero de four system. So, the volume dynamics of the de zero brain in the presence of the four brains. Okay, so now let's look at the system. So this is quantum mechanics with eight supercharges. So it comes very naturally from the reduction of a six-dimensional theory. So it's a six-dimensional n equals one theory, and that's the reason for, so this is the R symmetry here, that's the reason for the spin five factor. So that's just the transverse SO5 that you reduce on. And then you have this SU2R, which is just, okay, so one way of seeing it is it's a property of, say, n equals two supersymmetry in four dimensions, which is what this is equivalent to. So now we have this SU2R times spin five R symmetry, and well, so we need to write down what is the Lagrangian. Well, the best way of constructing these n equals two Lagrangians is by starting with an n equals one Lagrangian and then, imposing this SU2R symmetry. So, okay, so this contains contributions from an n equals two vector multiplet, an n equals two hypermultiplet, and some Yukawa couplings. So the n equals two vector multiplet in n equals one language has A, which is an n equals one chiral, V, which is an n equals one vector, phi and phi tilde are n equals to one chiral fields, and then I have this particular form of the superpotential, which is fixed by requiring that there is this SU2R symmetry. Now there are five real parameters that I want to point out to you. So this mu is a complex quantity, so it's, you know, it has two real scalars in it. And this vector field V, so this is, you know, as I said, a four-dimensional n equals one vector. So there is a gauge field in there, and this gauge field has three spatial components. So that's three real scalars here and two there, making a total of 5 real scalars, which
I thought that for any group to supersymmetry, the additional term is a superpotential. Unlike if your phis are charged and there's a gauge group, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there will be a coupling with the superpotential between what do you call A is a chiral multiplet?
It is N equals 1.
Yes, N equals 1. So
it's a chiral, so there should be a coupling, like, you know, if 5 would be in A joint, there would be 5.
Right, but it's U1, so we're thinking
oh,
of 1
okay,
is 0.
Okay.
So
you're right.
So that would be like an adjoint hypermultiplet. But I'm, so, sorry, but
so
it's, N, it's 1 to 0 brain and N before brain, so
okay.
That will become clear in the other. But
if it is 1.
Yeah, so there is no charge under the
okay.
Adjoint. Okay. But it's, of course, it's true if you go to more than 1 to 0 brain, that would be present. Okay, so here are the details. So the vector multiplet, so the G squared is just the zero brain gauge coupling, and these X are the 5 scalars. So right, so these scalars have the interpretation as the transverse center of mass coordinates of the zero brain. So what I have is I have this stack of the 4 brains, so N of them. And I have a single zero brain. And I could have connecting strings. And what X is, it's just the transverse displacement of this zero brain in the space transverse to the four brains. Okay? So I'm suppressing the dynamics of this zero brain and it's as it's translated parallel to the four brains because there's complete translation invariance for just one zero brain. Okay, so now this N, so the number of the four brains, manifests itself as a flavor index on these hypermultiplet fields. So the flavor goes from 1 to the number of the four brains. And the strings, so these strings that stretch the 0-4 strings, are actually, so these degrees of freedom are encoded by these hypermultiplet fields. So, you know, one way of seeing it, for instance, is that this quadratic interaction between X and phi, if you think of it as being at fixed X, then this is like a mass term for these bosonic fields in the hypermultiplet, and it gives them a mass which is proportional to the distance X. So this is like, you know, this is like strings. And right, so most interesting though is on this slide is this term, the Yukawa term, and in particular this first contribution here, which I want to direct your attention to. So these psi's here encode the hypermultiplet fermions. X is what I told you, and gamma is a set of 5 4x4 matrices which satisfy the SO5 Clifford algebra. So these are the 5-dimensional Euclidean gamma matrices. Okay, so this is, I mean, so this is just what, you know, it comes out in a kind of a convenient notation. And another element is this matrix J. It's just a symplectic matrix. And this reflects the fact that lambda and J lambda star form the symplectic Majorana doublet in 6 dimensions. Okay, so how can you make progress with a complicated system like this? Well, one trick is the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which goes back to 1927. And for simplicity now, I'm also taking N is equal to 1. So this N equal 1 is not related to the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, but I'm doing it for simplicity now. So 1 to 0 brain and 1 to 4 brain. But what I'm doing is I'm letting the gauge coupling G squared go to 0. Well, so why am I doing it? So physically speaking, this 1 over the gauge coupling squared is like, for this non-relativistic dynamics, it's just like a mass, right? So this is like a non-relativistic kinetic term. So 1 over G squared is like the mass of the zero brain. So what I'm doing is I'm making this zero brain extremely heavy. And that has the effect, that has precisely the effect of making the dynamics of these hypermultiplets much faster, in the sense that I will come to in a second, than the dynamics of the zero brain. So in the context of the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which applied to molecules, the zero brain would be like the heavy nucleus, and these hypermultiplets would be like the light electron states, the fast-moving electron states. And then what Born and Oppenheimer did was they said, well, if this nucleus is moving so slowly,
from the point of view of these electron orbitals, it really is just a parametric quantity. So we can solve for the electron orbits in the presence of the very heavy nucleus and get these eigenfunctions, and then use these eigenfunctions to come up with a ansatz for the overall wave function. Okay, so this is like a quantum mechanical way of integrating out the dynamics of the electrons, or in this case, the dynamics of the hypermultiplets. Okay, so I'm actually physically going to a limit where I'm forcing the zero brain to be so heavy that the Lagrangian reduces to, or the Hamiltonian already reduces to one, in which these X field now, so the center of mass degrees of freedom of the zero brain, are the kinetic term is decoupled, so they don't really move. Okay, so then I'm left with this kind of Hamiltonian. So I have these two canonically conjugate momenta to phi and phi tilde, which are pi and pi tilde. And I have now this really bona fide mass term, x squared. So this is now really a mass term, not a quartic interaction anymore. And I'm still left with this Yukawa type term, which I'm referring to as HF, the fermionic Hamiltonian. And so now what do fermions do in quantum mechanics? Well, they just create the fermionic Hilbert space. So what do? Well, I quantize these fermions, so they anti-commute into the unit matrix. So I have this reference state, which I choose to be annihilated by all psi. It is unique, and HF acting on it gives you zero. Then I have the first excited states, so psi bar alpha acting on this. There are four of them because there are four indices, four free. This index alpha goes from 1 to 4. And here I see that my states come in these degenerate pairs from Kramers degeneracy. So I have minus x twice and plus x twice. Then I have this middle sector, which is just antisymmetric in alpha and beta, six states. And then I have the duals of the 1 and the 0 state. OK, so what's the ground state of the system? Well, I still have to think about the bosons. There are these two bosons, which are like, you know, harmonic oscillators. So I put them in the ground state, which is a nice Gaussian. And each of these bosons will give me plus x in their ground state to the overall energy. So I need to choose this particular state to go back to zero again, you know, plus 2x minus 2x. So what I'm telling you is that the ground state of the system is in the two Fermi sector, and it corresponds to this particular eigenvalue. So one thing that I can comment on is that, again, this de zero de four system here has a unique ground state in this limit anyway. So what we're seeing here is kind of this statement that the de zero de four brain system should have a unique bound state at threshold. Of course, we haven't really contributed to the discussion there because we're looking at a limit in which, you know, it seems to become obvious. But then the first excited states are located in this sector where I'm taking only minus x away from the plus 2x contribution of the bosons. So this will be excited with respect to the ground state. And I'm going to focus on these first excited states very soon, so in this sector and in this sector. OK, so why am I focusing on these excited states? Well, because first of all, you look at the ground state and you see, does it undergo a Berry phase? And the answer is no. So the Berry phase is everywhere pure gauge. But look at the first excited state. So these are located in this psi bar sector. And well, you have to pick some basis now for these two degenerate states. So call them 1 and 2. I'm just denoting the expansion coefficients of this by lambda. And I've also defined a projector which projects me onto this negative energy eigenspace. And now you just go through this mechanics of calculating the Berry connection. So this non-abelian form thereof. This guy. And it turns out that you just get a very nice expression. You get this expression here. So I should point out two quantities. These eta m nu nu are the self-dual Toff matrices. So M is an SU2 index. And that's contracted with the SU2 index M on the Pauli matrices. And this is, of course, a local expression now for the object that I've constructed. So local in the sense that I've made a gauge choice, which is a choice of these two states in the beginning. And I'm also making a specific choice about the representation of these gamma matrices that I'm using. And that specific choice just means that the 5 component of this field is identically 0, which is quite useful. And then you look around the literature and you ask, what is this object that I've constructed? It turns out it is precisely this Yang monopole. So this is a local expression for the vibration of, so for an object which corresponds to the vibration of S7 as a 3-sphere vibration over S4. which is also known as the second Hopf map. So what does it mean? Well, if you take the field strength of this and you integrate F wedge F over any force sphere in R5, you get this second Chern number minus 1. So it's like having an instanton on every S4 that grows in size such to ensure that this integral always gives you minus 1. So the name Young monopole is actually a bad choice. It's really more directly related to an instanton. But I think it's called the Young monopole because it's the direct generalization of the Dirac monopole. And we'll see later in what sense. So OK, so I should say this, of course, is an SU2 valued connection. OK, so now there were these other two ground states in the 3 Fermi sector. So let's look at the first excited state in this 3 Fermi sector. I should say, of course, that this Hamiltonian that I showed you in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation doesn't mix these two sectors. So we're allowed to consider them independently. OK, so now this star psi, this involves this matrix J that I told you about. And then it's just a dual. So this is what I mean by star psi alpha. Okay, so it's in the 3 Fermi sector, and it's just this particular linear combination, which is a choice of basis again. So I get these states 3 and 4, and I do the same thing. I go through the mechanics of calculating the Berry connection, and I find this following object, which is precisely the same that we had before, but now it has these anti-self-dual Kauf matrices here, eta bar. And the difference here is that if you integrate the second Chern number, now you get plus 1. But if you integrate F wedge F, you get plus 1 rather than minus 1. So rather than calling it the anti-Yang monopole because it's kind of oppositely charged, we decided to call it the Yin monopole. Both of these have a singularity along positive x5, which is kind of which is also reflecting the gauge choice that we made before. So what you can do with these, you can put them together in this way. So similar to what I showed you with the Dirac monopole. You can put them in a 4x4 block form where you have the Yang monopole here and the Yin monopole there, and you leave the off diagonals 0. And the merit of this, and we'll also see in a minute why we would want to do this, the merit of this is that you can now actually apply a gauge transformation which itself is singular along positive x5 to bring it into a manifestly non-singular form, which takes this particular expression. So now it's really only singular at the center. So these gamma nu nu are the SO5 spinner generators. It's really only singular at the center. So I've removed this Dirac singularity. And well, again, the singularity at the center actually is reflecting the fact that the states are becoming degenerate there. So this is, again, the point of level crossing. But now it's pairs of states that become degenerate. OK? So your comment, for instance, now one of the things that, of course, is true here is that the overall F wedge F is minus 1 plus 1, so it's 0. So that's why we can actually make this guy disappear. I think that's, yeah. Right, so now let's go and try and use this machinery of the brain setup that we have to shed some more light on this object. Well, now we're actually, so let's take the perspective of really integrating out these hypermultiplets. So this is what I tried to argue to you before that the Born-Oppenheimer approximation does. So now we're taking these hypermultiplets and we're literally integrating them out. So in some sense, what I'm trying to convince you also is that this Born-Oppenheimer approximation really is instance of Wilsonian type effective actions, but in quantum mechanics. So I'm getting rid of the fast degrees of freedom, which happen to be the light degrees of freedom in quantum mechanics. And I can get rid of them also by literally integrating out. So these are two contributions if I integrate out the hypermultiplets. So the propagating degrees of freedom are the hypermultiplet bosons phi and phi tilde. And well, OK, so this is done, of course, with the background field method. and you have this external delta x at frequency k. So, and the sum of these diagrams is the following expression. So you see that it renormalizes the kinetic term. So I have 1 over 8x cubed, and I get a contribution like this for each phi. Then I get 1 for phi tilde, that gives me the 1 over 4, and then there are n of them because I have n default brains. So that shows you that this is precisely the renormalization I get for the kinetic term. So this, that's why I'm showing you these diagrams as well. Those are the ones that renormalize the kinetic term of the x. So now I have these x's, and they now move in a non-trivial metric. And this metric has this kind of throat behavior here. So what I've done is nothing but recovered the back reactive solution of the default brains, of course. So that's what this f is also. It's the transverse function of the default brains as written in string theory units. Sorry, as written in field theory units. Right, so now if you do the whole integrating out procedure, you get an effective action, and you get an effective action now for x, so the translational degree of freedom of the zero brain and its superpartners lambda. And this effective action now should somehow encode the Berry phase. And well, so how do we see this Berry phase? Well, here is my algorithm for seeing it. So look at this term. So typically, in these effective actions, the Berry phase term is the one that comes linear in velocity. So that's the candidate here. So, however, what we need to do is we need to focus on the throat region. And here, g squared n is much greater than x cubed. So this is the region where I can forget about the first term here, the one in this transverse metric. I should say that we're allowed to do it because there is a non-renormalization theorem again. This time it's due to Diaconescu and Entin, which allows us to extrapolate this to that region. So this result is actually one loop exact. Now it turns out that this region there, so this throat region of, in the language of brains, the Coulomb branch, is actually the strong coupling description of the entire Higgs branch dynamics. So this is something which is due to Berkus and Verlinde. So now this is precisely what we want to look at. We want to look at the dynamics of these phi and phi tilde, but from the point of view of having integrated out the hypermultiplets. And so this we do by going into this throat. Well, and now we have this term, sorry, I should say we have this term here, which basically, from the point of view of this Lagrangian, describes classical spin precession. So this is like the gravitational spin connection. So here I have a curved background, and I have a probe de zero brain. And this probe de zero brain has fills out an entire multiplet. And this multiplet has states which have some spin. And this spin couples to the curvature through this pullback of the spin connection. So this is like a gravitationally covariant derivative for the lambdas. So what happens is that the spin of the de zero brain picks up a precession as the de zero brain moves around now the background of the back reacted default brains. Okay? So you can read off what it is, and it turns out to be precisely this expression here. So it's the same as we got from the quantum mechanical computation up to a factor of 3/2. Okay? So this factor of 3/2 is what we believe is the manifestation of the strong coupling. So this, of course, is now actually valid in the opposite regime of this coupling g squared n over x cubed. And what we get is we get precisely the same kind of functional form for the Berry phase, but we get this modified coefficient in front. This coefficient, of course, is quite significant because it now means that it actually mixes all four states, not just two in pairs. Okay, so what this computation that we did now did for us is it sort of suggests a new method to compute the Berry phase. So in some sense, you know, we were lucky that by just integrating out the hypermultiplets, we got this one loop exact result, and we could actually explore the entire Coulomb branch with it. And we found that in the throat,
well, I mean, I can tell you
the precise reason. So this is this very long, arduous paper by Diaconescu and Entin, and they just write down a superfield formulation for these 8 supercharged quantum mechanics. And they find that the kinetic term, the most general kinetic term that you can write down is this one. So I don't know if you can think of it in terms of localization. Perhaps you should tell me how. But I think we can talk about it. It's not obvious to me that it's related to localization. Right, so it was the same with a 1 here instead of 3 halves. OK? So OK, so this method that presents itself to us now is the following. So you take some background. For us, it's the background of n default brains. And you insert a D0 brain as a probe. Now, this D0 brain then feels the presence of the D4 brains through the gravitational background that they have created. So now f of r is now, just you read it up from the literature, it's this D4 brain transverse function now written in string units. Of course, it has to be what we got before, just because, well, that's what you do. If you integrate out the hypermultiplets in this D0 of D4 system, you recover this transverse function. But this, of course, is more general now. You could think of doing this for some other setup as well. Then what you do is you take the DBI action for this D0 brain, and you expand it to second order. And then use supersymmetry. You write down the supersymmetric completion. And you end up with the full, as you were, Coulomb branch quantum mechanics of this D0 brain. This is what it is. So apart from the terms that I showed you already, it just has another bunch of 4 Fermi couplings, which couple into the Riemann tensor. So this is just an explicit expression for the Riemann tensor of the conformally flat metric transverse to the 4 brains.
The precession rate has increased when you transform from weak to strong.
I think you can think about it in that way, but it's almost more significant, in my opinion, that with this coefficient of 3 halves, you can't really go into a frame anymore where you have Yang here and anti-Yang there and zero there. So what it means is that the 4 states that you had are now manifestly mixing. So you can't decouple them into pairs of 2 anymore. It's strong coupling. Right, so as you crank up this g squared n over x cubed, this coefficient somehow goes from 1 to 3 halves. OK, now I'm already suggesting something to you, which I don't have any right to, the fact that it's linear, sorry, that it's a smooth interpolation. But yeah, so the strength of the precession, I think you can, yeah, you can sort of interpret that there is more. OK, so but I should also sort of fill in that what I mean by spin is the R symmetry representation of this of the state that I'm looking at. OK? Right, so let me give you a brief outlook on some work in progress. Now, this is trying to answer the question, what happens if you have more than 1 D0 brains in a simpler setup? So let's take just 2 D0 brains that can be connected by strings, as depicted here. And you separate them out. And so that's like breaking this SU2 to the Cartan subalgebra. So SU2, because we just looked at the relative motion, we're not really interested in the center of mass translation. And then you decide a string between these brains and ask what happens as one moves around the other. And it turns out that here you get a Berry phase which corresponds to the octonionic SOA connection. So that's like going yet to the last hop map. So we looked at the second hop map, which gave us a Yang monopole. We have the first hop map, which is actually the Dirac monopole. And now for these 2 D0 grains for the 16 VO supercharged system, we get this last hop map. So I have a slide which goes over this in detail. So this is another sort of theme that emerges and will be the topic of a forthcoming paper, is that you have this relation. So I should, of course, say that this relation between division algebras and supersymmetry is an old one and is well known, but perhaps not this relation to the Berry phase. So what we have here is we have 4 systems with 2, 4, 8, and 16 real supercharges. And those are related to the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions and the octonions, which are the 4 division algebras we have. And what you get with these division algebras for free are these hop maps. And what we show is that these hop maps are precisely the Berry phase
in these supersymmetric systems. So the first one, so if you have this type of model, you can have the Berry phase is actually just discrete, so it can be minus one or plus one. Okay, and this is essentially this vibration of Z2 over RP1 to give S1. Then the U1 Dirac monopole is this vibration of S1 over CP1 to get S3, which is, as we saw, comes out in this post-supercharged quantum mechanics. We saw that the vibration of S3 over HP1, which is S4 to give S7, gives us the Yang monopole in the 8 supercharged phase. And I just showed you that the octonionic version of this, so S8 5 over S7 to give S15, comes out in the 16 supercharged phase. So there is this beautiful picture of having the, you know, increasing the number of supercharges, getting
these very natural geometric objects as Berry phases. So in other words, there are these four hop maps because of the four division algebras, and you get precisely four Berry connections, four different Berry connections. Okay, so that brings me to my summary. So especially with the last slide also, I hope to have shown you that Berry phase is a very natural concept in supersymmetric systems, or at least non-abelian Berry phases. You can realize these four different phases very naturally. So you can get the sign flip in the 2 supercharged case, the Dirac in the 4 supercharged case, the Yang monopole in the 8 supercharged case, and the octonionic monopole in the 16 supercharged case. It's the 2 to 0 brands. Yeah. In fact, you can realize all of this in terms of a matrix model that is very much like the 2 to 0 brain case. You know, so these matrix models just come from reducing pure Yang mills in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions. And you can get precisely this. This is the matrix model you get from reducing the 3-dimensional Yang mills, this 4, 6, and 10-dimensional one. And of course, these kind of have an interpretation as being superparticles moving in a transverse space. But the de Zero brain interpretation, of course, is strictly only true for this. Okay. Right. So, but also, if you have 4 supercharges, you can construct this non-abelian phase by looking at the vacua, space of vacua protected by the Witten index, which I showed you on one slide. In the n equals 8 case, you actually can get this Berry phase. You can recover it in the strongly correlated case by looking at gravitational precession, which I think is very exciting. Of course, there ought to be a relation. So this, of course, has some interpretation in terms of the 5-dimensional gauge theory on these default brains. So in particular, of course, we just looked at the one instance on moduli space and looked at it from that point of view. But this relation that there is a very natural gauge connection on this one instance on moduli space should be something interesting from the point of view of these default brains. Okay, so that's something that's kind of interesting to look at. Another very interesting direction to go into is to actually look for applications. So now I hope to have convinced you that there is some algorithm for getting the strongly correlated Berry phase by looking at this brain precession. And the question is it actually good for anything? So can we kind of engineer a setup, perhaps even a non-supersymmetric setup, a brain setup, along the spirit of, say, ADS QCD or what, you know, people do there, and look at some brain setup that encodes an interesting system, condensed matter system, you know, so the global symmetries, the field content, and so on. And then you can actually use this method to compute the strongly correlated Berry phase in the system. And then the question is, you know, are there some applications? Would condensed matter people be interested in hearing about this? Okay, so I'll stop there. Thanks.
Yes, but it wouldn't be the Yang monopole because that's kind of related to this SO5. So I don't know what the object would be.
But there wouldn't be any gravitational precession because there is, after X, there is no other direction.
Oh, okay, so it couldn't be, you couldn't have a non-trivial curve around it. No, so I'd have to look into it, but. So we haven't looked at the inference.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker.